Deb Halleck was in our last service, and so I just had to say to her, none taken. I learn more preparing my sermons than I do listening to them. And I would concur that you're going to get more out of the Word of God when you're actually studying it, teaching it, than when you're listening to it. And I encourage you all to consider participating as teachers in our children's ministry. In 1937, the best-selling fiction novel on the shelves that year was Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. Same year, the best-selling nonfiction book was written by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. The thing that's interesting about 1937 is that both of those books have continued to be good sellers even up until the present. One, because it was an incredible novel, and the other is because it contains those types of things to help us with one of the most pressing issues in our world, and that is the issue of friendships, how to relate to people, how to build bridges and connections to other people. We've come to our study in the book of Proverbs where we're going to discuss the topic of friendship this morning. Now, I want you to understand the logical connection that's taking place in the book of Proverbs. First, in Proverbs, we learn that our life consists of that which flows out of our hearts. We define the heart as the inner person, that part of you where the feelings, the emotions, the will, the thinking, that part of you is what determines what your life will be like. And that part of you is the part of you that meditates and thinks thoughts over and struggles and wrestles with ideas. And whatever is going on inside of you, whatever you play over and over again in your mind and in your heart, whatever you're dealing with, living with, thinking about, will eventually be what your life consists of. How do you reach into someone else's inner life? Last week we talked about the priority of words. And how if you want to change a person's heart, or if you want to be able to reach in and connect on the inside with them, you can use words to actually get in. Last week we talked about the fact that there are life words and there are death words. You can speak words that will go into a person's inner being, that they will meditate on, think about, relate to, that will actually give them life. It will encourage them. It will give them truth. It will strengthen them. But you can also speak words into a person's soul, into their inner life, into their heart, which will be demoralizing and discouraging, or maybe false, maybe something that's untrue. And as they meditate on those words, will actually undermine their life. And so, it comes down to, as people, if we truly have a desire to grow and to be people who are alive and living, that we would want to be around relationships, friendships, people that are speaking life into us, and we would want to avoid being connected with people who would be speaking death into our existence. And so the first principle on friendship that we see in the book of Proverbs is choose wisely because friends can influence your life. The people that you run with, the people that you hang around with, are not merely passive. They're active participants in the development of who you are as an individual. Now, this morning, we're going to look at a number of Proverbs, and I'm going to put them up on the screen so you can follow along, because we're going to move very rapidly through a number of passages of Scripture. And the first one we're going to look at is in Proverbs chapter 12, verse 26. And that proverb says, "A righteous man is cautious in friendships, but the way of the wicked leads them astray." Literally, this passage is saying that a righteous man makes an investigation of the character of the people that he associates himself with. He takes a deep look into the motives, the behaviors, the ideas, and the ideals of the people that he develops relationships with, because he wants to have some people in his life, his closest friends, not just his acquaintance, but his closest friends, he wants them to be people that will actually be telling him the truth, that will be speaking truth, that will be helping him, and that keeps him on the track of righteousness. In chapter 13, verse 20, Proverbs says, "He who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm." In other words, we're influenced by the people we hang around with. If we hang around with wise people, we will end up becoming a wise person. If we hang around with fools, well, we'll become a foolish person. I was talking to a young man in his 20s a while back, and he was wrestling with the whole issue of where did he go with his life, and he was kind of a shiftless, and he couldn't really stick with his commitments, and he was struggling because he really wanted to do right, but he just didn't have the motivation and the courage to step out and do right. And so I asked him the question, if you end up where you believe your friends are going, are you going to be satisfied with that? He said, oh no, I don't want to end up where I believe my friends are going. I said, what makes you think that you won't? So where do you want to end up? He said, well, you know, I really want to end up where my dad is. You know, even though my dad's kind of plain vanilla, even though my dad is kind of boring, even though I don't really want to do the things that my dad does to get there, that's where I really want to end up. Now I said, well, ask yourself the question. If you run with the fools, where are you going to end up? If you run with the wise, where are you going to end up? Think about where you want to be. Because if you run with the right kind of people, they will have a very positive influence on your life. If you run with the wrong people, you adopt their values, you adopt their ideals, you adopt their standards, and where are you going to end up? You're going to end up in the wrong place. Interestingly enough, all of us, no matter how strong we might be, have some level of peer pressure influencing our lives. A study was done a number of years ago by a Dr. Ruth Berta, and she and a group of psychologists decided to study this whole issue of peer pressure. And so what they did was they would bring 10 teenagers into a room, and they would put before them three charts with a line drawn on each of the charts. One line was short, one line was medium in length, and the other line was long. And it was obvious that they were different lengths. And they asked the teenagers to point to the one or to raise their hand when they pointed to the line that was the longest. What everybody didn't know is that 9 of the people in the room had been told to always choose the middle line, the one that's the medium length. And one person in the room didn't know that the other 9 were setting him up. You know what happened? 75% of the time, the people that were brought in and tested would go with the crowd, even though it was obvious that they were picking the wrong line. 75% of the people in this test study did not have the courage to say, are you guys blind? Are you guys crazy? That line is not the longest one. And that's the tendency of people in this world. I thought it was humorous this morning. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but as the kids are coming down the aisle, and they're coming down in two lines, and they're supposed to peel off and go this way, but every once in a while, a child from this line would forget and kind of cross over and go that way, and what would happen? A whole bunch of them would start going this way. And Doug and I are sitting down on the front row, and we're watching the real conscientious, you know, that 25% that are kind of scratching their head, and they're thinking, no, we're supposed to be going this way. We're supposed to be going this way. But a lot of those would fall in and go the wrong way because we don't want to do something different than the crowd. You say, well, that's children, that's teenagers. What happens in your office when everybody in your group has a new car? Don't you start feeling like, man, my car is really, really old. What's wrong with me? Or when everybody in your department says, you know, we really need to go full force and work the next 6 weekends so we can get a big bonus check at the end of the year. What do? Even though you've got commitments on the next 6 weekends, the tendency is to flow with the people that you hang with. Peer pressure is a very powerful thing. So we must choose our friends wisely. Now in the Proverbs, we see that there are a number of people or a number of types of friendships to avoid. Let me share 4 of them with you. The first friendship to avoid at all costs, a dangerous friendship, is a friendship that's built around money. A friendship that's built around money. In Proverbs 19:4, it says, wealth brings many friends, but a poor man's friends desert him. In other words, if someone is hanging on to you because of what you have, or you're hanging on to them because of what they have, or you're hanging on to each other because of what you think you can amass together, that is not a safe relationship to build. That's not a good way to build a relationship. It's interesting to me how people relate to those who have money. I have a friend that has money, and he was telling me one time, Tim, you don't know how hard it is to have money. And I thought, well, I've got some suggestions for what you can do to relieve your burden. He said, Tim, you know what? He said, I always wonder when people are my friends, I always wonder if they're being with me because of what they're going to get out of me or because they really like me for who I am. And then he began to cite example after example of people that he started to develop a relationship with only to have them hit him up for a loan after a few months. Building a relationship around money, you're going to find out that when the money's there, the relationship works. When the money goes, the relationship falls apart. Some of you may have read the story a few years ago of two unlikely people that hooked up at a cafe in Big Spring, Texas. It's one of those old cafes, the name was Herman's, with the old Formica top counter, wood grain that's all worn out. And there was a retired oil worker, R.C. Mills, that used to hang out there. He'd go there to eat dinner, and he met a gal there, Carol Raines, who was the waitress there. And the two of them talked, and they became friends. They started a little relationship of interaction. But one of the things that they always did was they always hooked up over things like the local betting pool. Whatever was going on in sports, they always had a little stake in it. They would always put a little money into it. And when Carol began to fall on hard times and financially things began to go south for her, R.C. was such a good guy that he decided, well, I'm going to help her out. I'm going to buy a lottery ticket. So he'd go to the Easy Mart, and he'd buy one for himself and one for her, and they'd get together, and the scratch kind, they'd scratch them off together, and sometimes they'd win five, and sometimes they'd win 10, and most of the time they'd win nothing. But whenever they won anything, they'd split the money. Well, as this time went by, he continued to buy lottery tickets and give her lottery tickets, and in May of 1995, the Texas Lotto was up to $55 million. And he went into the Easy Mart, bought a lottery ticket, handed it to her. And guess what? It won. 12.9 million of the 55 was her portion. When he came in to talk to her about it the next day, she immediately said, well, you know, that's not the ticket that you gave me. That was a ticket my daughter bought. And so he got his lawyer and she got her lawyer. And finally they traced it back to the clerk at the Easy Mart and determined that truly that was the ticket that he bought. Now, they each share half of $12.9 million. But they share no friendship. They're not on speaking terms anymore. Because their friendship was built around money. And when the money went away, the friendship went away too. Avoid friendships that are simply built on financial gain. Those are weak friendships. Secondly, avoid friendships that draw you into sin. With people that want you to do things that are wrong. Notice in Proverbs chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, my son, if sinners entice you, do not give in to them. If they say, come along with us. And then the passage goes on to describe their behavior. You know, there are always people that don't enjoy doing things wrong by themselves. It's just not as much fun unless they can get other people involved. And they'll try to get you involved if they can. Come on, let's just do this together. We'll just do this together. This will be fun. Let's go. Let's have a great time. Let's go mess around. Let's mess up. I asked my son one time when we were talking about this verse, do you know anybody who's like that? And he said, yeah, there's a boy in my class. He said, the boy in my class says, Ben, it's okay to sin sometimes. It's okay to sin sometimes. Come on. Let's do it together. I said, Ben, tell him to do it by himself. Let him do it by himself. There are people that will seek you out to try to involve you in their plans and schemes. Avoid those types of people. The third type of relationship or friendship to avoid is one that's filled with anger. One that's filled with anger. Notice 22, 24, and 25. It says, do not make friends with a hot-tempered man. Do not associate with one easily angered, or you may learn his ways and get yourself ensnared. Isn't that interesting? You hang around someone that's got a chip on their shoulder, that's angry, that's mad at the world, and the tendency is for that to become something that you get. It's contagious. It'll rub off on you. I had a great friend in seminary that we had known each other for a number of years, and he hung around with this one particular guy who was just a cynic, angry at the world. And whenever I'd get together with them, I'd say, Jim, I mean, I'd come away thinking, why do you hang around with this guy? I said, everything is critical. He's just angry at the world. And one day Jim came to me and he said, I told my friend that I couldn't hang around with him anymore because I told him that I am starting to get that way too. I'm starting to get cynical. I'm starting to get angry. I thought that I would have a positive influence on him, but he's had a negative influence on me. Billy Martin, in his autobiography, number one, tells an incredible story about the days when he and Mickey Mantle were hanging out. For those of you who don't follow baseball, especially ancient baseball, Billy Martin was the infamous coach of a number of teams, had a drinking problem, and was kind of a brawler, and he was one of those guys that, you know, was known for having a bad temper. Well, he and Mickey Mantle used to come to a particular place in Texas and hunt on a fella's ranch. And one day they came and they drove up to this guy's ranch, and Mickey Mantle said to Billy Martin, "You just sit in the car, I'm going to go in and talk to this guy and ask him if we can hunt." So he went in, talked to the guy. The guy says, "Sure, you guys can hunt, but I need you to do me a favor." He said, "I got an old mule in the barn. Thing's blind, it's sick, it's suffering, it's old. Somebody needs to do this mule in, and you know, I've had it for so long, I just don't have the heart. Could you slip down to the barn and put this animal out of its misery before you guys go out to hunt?" And of course, Mickey Mantle says, "Sure, I'll do it for a friend." And so he went and got back in the car, slammed his fist on the steering wheel and said, "I just can't believe it. The guy said we can't hunt on his place. After all these years and driving all the way out here, he's not going to let us hunt." And Billy Martin looked at him and thought, "What's the deal?" And Mickey Mantle slammed his car in reverse and peeled backwards and then slammed it in drive and started headed toward the barn. And he said, "I'm going to show him." Pulled up in front of the barn, slammed the thing into park, jumped out, grabbed his hunting rifle, put a shell in the chamber. He said, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" Billy Martin said, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to go shoot his mule." So he goes running into the barn, pulls up his gun. He's laughing the whole time. Boom, shoots the mule. He's starting to walk back toward the door of the barn, and all of a sudden he hears two shots. He comes running out of the barn, and there's Billy Martin, face red, his gun still smoking. He said, "What did you do?" And Billy Martin said, "We got him good. I killed two of his cows." Hey, anger's contagious. You start hanging around people that are angry, they got to have a chip on their shoulder, and that'll rub off on you. Watch out for those relationships. The final one is rebellion. It's rebellion. Rebel without a cause. Notice 24, 21, and 22. It says, "Fear the Lord and the king, my son, and do not join with the rebellious, for those two will send sudden destruction upon them, and who knows what calamities they can bring." Isn't that interesting? He says, fear God, and also fear the king. That would be your civil authority or anybody that's in authority over you. He said, don't hang out with the rebellious because authorities in your life have the power to make life miserable. He says, who knows what these two, God and the king, will do if you're involved in rebellion. And many of us think that we can get away with rebellion, that we can go do things against the authority in our life, whether it's the governmental authority, whether it's the authority of our bosses, whether it's spiritual authority, whether it's the authority of our parents or whoever God's placed in our life. And that's kind of in vogue, to rebel, to do our own thing, to go away from that. But this passage is warning us. The people in charge can make life hard for you. How many people who have a regular, contentious relationship with their boss at work actually benefit from that type of approach? You don't benefit from rebellion. You suffer from rebellion. That's difficult. And you know, rebellion may be something that you get away with your mom and dad, but God is always looking down from heaven, and he sees rebellious attitudes, and God hates rebellion. God removed Saul, the first king of Israel, from the throne because he didn't obey God. And in that passage in 1 Samuel, God compares rebellion to the sin of divination or of witchcraft. Here's what he's saying. He's saying this. He's saying that to obey God is to worship God. To obey or to disobey God or disobey those people in authority is to obey the one who is the ultimate in rebellion. And who is that? That's Satan. That's ultimately idolatry. So when you have a directive in your life and you say, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to follow that, you're choosing to give your allegiance to Satan. Teenagers, when you've got friends who are asking you to go rebel, go do your own thing, do things that are wrong, and you know that they're wrong, you know what they're doing? Those people are being an advocate for Satan in your life. And you've got to ask yourself the question, do I want to run with these people? Because to run with rebellious people will lead you down the path of rebellion, and there will be consequences in your life. So rather than getting ourselves involved in dangerous friendships, what we ought to be doing is involving ourselves in good relationships, creating positive friendships in our life. Now, I believe that most of us here would really love to have positive friendships, and some have very deep positive friendships, and others are saying, you know, I've tried to develop positive friendships, and if you could just show me a good person, somebody that would really commit to me, that I could really commit to, then I would love to have that kind of a friend. What I want to do is turn the tables on you a little bit, because what you're going to discover in life is finding a person to be your friend. That's the hard part. That's the hard part. In fact, finding a person to be your friend is almost impossible. So the place you need to start is with yourself. In fact, Dale Carnegie said this. He said, you can make more friends in 2 months by becoming really interested in other people than you can in 2 years by trying to get other people interested in you. Which is just another way of saying that the way to make a friend is to be one. If you don't have friendships, the place to start is saying, what kind of a friend am I? Am I the kind of person that somebody would want to be friends with? You say, well, you know, that's really not the way I want to go about this. What I really want to see, what I really want to do, how I really want to define friendship is, I want to just be myself, and I want a friend who accepts me as I am, warts and all. The good, the bad, the ugly. I'm just going to be here. I'm just going to hang out. I'm going to be myself. And I expect that somebody will come along and adopt me as their friend. If that's what you're thinking, what I would say to you today is grow up. Face reality. The reality of life is that people want to be friends with those who are going someplace. Those who are making a positive contribution. Those who are sensitive. Those who are tuned in. And if you're saying, I just want to be myself, self-centered, self-oriented, my world is the most important world, and you expect that somebody's going to want to come in and embrace that, a friendship is based on a two-way offering. You have something to offer them, and they have something to offer you. It's not based on a passive, I'll just be myself and hope somebody shows up and embraces me. That's the stuff of fairy tales in Hollywood. If you want good friendships, then you need to become a good friend. And what I want us to do is spend a little bit of time evaluating the effort and the energy that we put in to becoming that kind of person, a good friend to other people. I read a story recently of a pastor named Jim who's in Anaheim, California. He and his wife Penny were out one day at the park, and they were coming around a tree, and this little boy about 10 years old named Billy came running around the tree and almost ran into him. And he looked up when he came running around the tree and he said, Dad, is Amy here? And then he realized that he was talking to strangers, and he said, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, I thought you were my dad. I made a mistake. And the man, Jim, looked down at him and said, son, we all make mistakes. That's fine. Well, Billy turned and began to walk away. And as he began to walk away, both Penny and Jim noticed for the first time his limp. And as they looked at his facial features, they realized that he was a Down syndrome child. He got about 10 yards away, and then he turned on his heels. And Billy came back, walked up to Jim and Penny, and this is what he said. He said, my name is Billy. You were both very nice to me. Can I give you a hug? After giving each of us a tight hug, he said, I just wanted you to know that you're my friends and I'm going to be praying for you. I have to go now and find my sister Amy. Goodbye and God bless you. And then he turned and walked away. He walked over to the slide, slid down the slide, and then a woman came up and gave him a big hug and a kiss and embraced him. And Jim and Penny thought, that's probably his mother, that she's taught him to smile and hug and love. And I wonder this morning, how many of you have embraced a stranger? How many of you have shown yourself friendly? How many of you smile when you see people? Think of how much better the world would be if, with the simplicity of a child, that we could reach out to people, that we could open up our hearts, that we could smile, that we could hug, that we could laugh, that we could speak, that we would show ourselves friendly. One of the best ways to make friends is to be friendly. I went out to find a friend, but could not find one there. I went out to be a friend, and found friends everywhere. I went out to find a friend and could not find one there. I went out to be a friend, and I found friends everywhere. When you go out to be a friend, you're going to see people respond to you. Now, what are the qualities of a good friend? Well, there are at least four of them in Proverbs, and I'm going to share those with you, and I've given you a little rating scale. This is a chance for you to evaluate yourself on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being never and 5 being always. Rate yourself. How do you view yourself on the scale of friendship? The first characteristic, well, the general principle of positive friendships is that in the quest for positive friendships, begin by becoming a positive friend. And the first characteristic is the characteristic of loyalty or loyal love. In Proverbs 17:17, it says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." A friend loves at all times, whether things are good or whether things are bad. And a brother, that is a blood brother, a family member, he's born not simply for the good times. Any person is present, happy in the good times. But they're there when things go wrong. And here he compares a good friend with a blood brother, someone that's there no matter what happens. Would you describe yourself? Would the people who know you, who are your friends, would they describe you as loyal? Would they describe you as always being there for them, whether things are good or bad, whether times are hard or easy? Are you the person who's there? Notice in verse 18, verse 24, 18:24, "A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." A man who has a million relationships, a mile wide and an inch deep, lots and lots of acquaintances, that person can come to ruin. Why? Well, you got a million people to please, and you got a million different opinions in your life. Recently, I talked to a woman who was telling me that all her friends have prescribed for her a course of action, which is completely unbiblical. She's listening to a myriad of counselors, but they're not telling her the truth. And there's a danger in having lots and lots of shallow surface relationships and not having some deep, good, solid friendships. So the question is, are you a loyal friend? One of the incredible stories that came out of World War I was in the midst of that bloody, bloody battle there in Europe, where the lines were drawn by trenches, and men lived and died taking a few feet of dirt each and every day, that on one particular day, there was a soldier who was with his commanding officer down in one of the trenches, and out between him and the enemy lay one of his best friends. That man was lying on the ground, not moving, mortally wounded, and for all they knew, he was dead. The friend turned to his commanding officer and said, "Can I go get my buddy and bring him back?" The officer looked at him and said, "No way. There's no way. He's probably dead. There's nothing you can do for him, and you'll get killed trying." The man insisted. And the officer said, "Well, I know it's not going to do any good, but if you insist on doing it, go ahead." And so this soldier climbed up out of that trench and began to work his way across that no man's land with the bullets flying and with the gas being sprayed throughout the area. And as he was going through there, fighting his way through there, he took a bullet. But he made it to his friend, and he picked up his friend, and he carried his friend back, and the two of them fell together into that trench. And there he lay, his dead friend and him mortally wounded. His commanding officer looked down at him and said, "I told you he was dead. I told you it wasn't worth it. Now look, you've gone and killed yourself." And before he died, he looked up at his commanding officer and he said, "Oh yes, it was worth it. For you see, when I reached my friend on the battlefield, he was still alive. And his last words to me were, 'Jim, I knew you would come for me. I knew you would come for me.'" Do people know that about you? People that would call you their friend, do they know that you would be there? You'd be there to help them, to support them. You're a loyal, loving person for them. Second characteristic, someone who keeps confidences. Someone who keeps confidences. Proverbs 25, 9 and 10 says, "If you argue your case with a neighbor, Do not betray another's confidence, or he who hears it may shame you, and you will never lose your bad reputation." That's a very insightful verse, because sometimes we do that, don't we? We're in the midst of a heated argument, and we need some support. And so we bring in some private, privileged information from somebody else that has shared something with us. We bring that in as fuel or support to win our argument. The writer of Proverbs says, don't do that. Because when you do that, you will demonstrate your lack of trustworthiness in relationships. You're going to shame yourself and people aren't going to trust you anymore. One of the most important characteristics of a friend is someone who can listen without blabbing your life to everyone else. Are you the kind of friend who can hear information and you're not waiting for the next prayer chain so you can pass it down the line? A juicy piece of gossip? You see, one of the characteristics of people who lack deep friendships is oftentimes they're loose with their tongue. They're willing to share information. And people realize, I can't give you my heart because if I give you my heart, you're going to give it away to everybody else. Are you the kind of person who can keep a confidence, who can be trusted? The third characteristic is someone who's sensitive to others. Sensitive to others. I love this proverb. Proverbs 25:20 says, like one who takes away a garment on a cold day, or like vinegar poured on soda, is one who sings songs to a heavy heart. Isn't that good? You know, somebody robs your coat when it's cold outside, what do you feel? It doesn't kill you, but it sure is irritating. In the same way that when you put vinegar and soda together, I mean, you don't have a nuclear explosion. It's not a holocaust of any by any nature, but it certainly causes a lot of agitation, doesn't it? In the same way, someone who's not tuned in, who's singing songs, when someone else is sad, when they're downcast, an insensitive person, you're going to have a lot of trouble making friends. And one of the best ways to become sensitive is to close your mouth and open your ears. From time to time, I'll have people share with me that they just can't seem to get anybody to like them. And they'll share with me, and they'll share with me, and an hour goes by, and they're still sharing with me how they can't get anybody to like them. And an hour and a half goes by, and they're still sharing with me how they can't get anyone to like them. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe if you quit thinking about you, if you quit talking about you, and you started thinking about someone else, started listening to other people, asking questions, finding out what's going on in their life, spending more time being tuned into how they feel and where they're at than where you're at, then you would have some people that wanted to be your friend. A sensitivity to others. Do you care about the needs, the hurts, and the pains of other people? As deeply as you feel, let me tell you, there are 6 billion people in this world that feel just as deeply. As important as your life is, there are 6 billion other people in the world that feel like their life is equally important. Are you tuned in? Are you sensitive? Or do you rub people the wrong way by your insensitivity in relationships? The final characteristic that I want to mention this morning is someone who's an encourager, someone who's honest. Notice 27:9. Perfume and incense bring joy to the heart, and the pleasantness of one's friend springs from his earnest counsel. As much as perfume, incense, they smell good, they fill the room with aroma, they're joyful, so is a person who's willing to give good advice to his friends. Someone who's really willing to listen to the problems of his friends, who's really willing to listen and care enough to pray about and study and think and get some good advice to be able to share with a friend, that is healing. That is sweet. How many people have a friend that really will walk through the difficult time with you and listen to you and give you good advice and give you good feedback? Let me tell you, teens and young people, some of you have parents who persevere in giving you good advice and good counsel. And you say, oh, that's just my mom or that's just my dad. They mean well, but I'm not going to listen to them. It's so sweet to have someone that gives you encouragement, that gives you good counsel, and also tells you the truth. 27:17 says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Well, you all know the process by which iron sharpens iron, don't you? You take a blade and you rub something over it, and what happens? In order to get that blade sharp, what happens? You have friction, you have sparks, you have heat. That's the same way that we as individuals become sharp. Someone comes alongside of us and rubs off the rough edges. Sometimes that hurts. Sometimes that creates heat. Sometimes that creates sparks. But if you want to be sharp, if you want to be a skillful tool, a precise tool as a person, you've got to have someone in your life that's sharpening you. How many of you would say that my friends like to be around me because I help them be better men and women? Because I tell them the truth in a loving, kind, godly way, and I work with them and I help them, and they're better off because they're around me. How many of you would have friends that would testify to that? Are you one who sharpens? Or are you simply one who allows people to be the way they are, even if the way they are is not their best? As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. One of the great untold stories of a great hero took place in the life of Ulysses S. Grant. Ulysses S. Grant was responsible for the Union side in the Civil War and had a very large responsibility on his shoulders. And he had a good friend who was also a military man. His name was John A. Rawlins. John A. Rawlins went to Ulysses S. Grant, approached him, and said, "Mr. Grant," they were friends, he said, "you cannot continue to drink and lead." And he had the courage to ask Ulysses S. Grant to give him his word that he would lay off intoxicating alcohol all during his time as the general. Well, there came a time when Ulysses S. Grant broke that promise, and John Rawlins went to him and looked him in the eye and confronted him. And he pleaded with him. He said, "Because of who you are, because of your responsibilities, because of the great things that are taking place in this world, in this nation, and they're on your shoulders, I implore you to keep your commitment." As iron sharpens iron, one friend went to sharpen another. Today, if you're to go visit the Capitol in Washington, D.C., you'll see Ulysses S. Grant's statue seated on a mounted horse, and around him the scenes of battle. But down Pennsylvania Avenue, a little bit to the south, you'll see a small park there that's dedicated to John A. Rawlins. And you'll see a statue in that park of John A. Rawlins. It's kind of a normal statue, looks like a normal guy. And what I want you to know, that when you look up at that great man mounted on that great horse, that there was another man, less in the public view, who kept Ulysses S. Grant on his horse by telling him the truth. Who is on their horse today? Who is being successful in life because you as a friend have told them the truth and you loved them and you wouldn't allow them to settle for something less than what they should be? Now that is true friendship. How many people would say that of you? We all live our lives, and the quality of our lives is determined to a large measure on our willingness to become good friends to other people. How would you rate your friendship? Are you a good friend? If you want to be a good friend, you can start today. Take these principles, begin to apply them in your life, and watch what God does to make you the kind of person that can truly minister to other people, and watch what God does in bringing you relationships that will breathe life into you. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, as we come to you, we just want to tell you how awesome it is to know that you are a friend that sticks closer than a brother, that you are a friend who will be with us at all times, but you've also called us to be like your Son, Jesus Christ. Father, we pray that you would teach us how to love other people, that we would build a supportive community of friendships that encourage and strengthen and help each other, that, Father, we would support and give life to one another so that people could see you. We look forward to how you're going to change us, for we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.